Abani Ghani, everyone. This is Professor Amin-Ra, Professor Emeritus, California State University of Long Beach, Africana Studies Department, former city councilman for the city of Compton, former Compton College Board of Trustees, and former Compton Unified School District Board of Trustees. We want to welcome you here to the Conscious Corner. And do we have an excellent, excellent program for you tonight. And we hope that those of you that chime in or come in really learn from this lesson. I urge you to get your pencils out and papers out, because we have one of the most fantastic guests tonight. This young man grew up in Carson. His family and extended family are probably the most well-known and most dynamic families that came out of Carson and the Long Beach area. This brother worked his way all the way up to become one of the most foremost attorneys, and he's been working on a lot of high-profile cases. And he's been working with Brother Ben Crump and others, and he's been the lead attorney in some major, major rulings and things of that nature. And we're very fortunate to have him to come share with us about what the criminal justice system and the black community from his vantage point. And he has a good vantage point, because he came up right in the hood, and he know how it was, how it is, and how it's probably going to be, and what we have to do to be able to navigate it, no matter what we're doing, right or wrong. But the point is that I'm just so happy. As I said, I know his family. His father is one of the most dynamic contractors in the area. His mother, Betty, she's one of the most dynamic women, along with his aunties, Chandra, who is Abraham's mother, and also Carmen Abdullah. And I'm hoping they will chime in. I sent them the link. But anyway, we're going to get right into it. And the other person that's co-hosting as a part of the program is a historian and educator and administrator, Brother Joe Hembrick. Brother Joe Hembrick is the first African-American head varsity coach for Linwood Unified School District. He also is the creator of the mural that is presently at Centennial before they tear it down and rebuild it. And I hope they ask him to come back and get that mural back up, brown and black people working together in unity. Brother Joe Hembrick is an outstanding historian on the mob tradition as well as ancient history. And he's the most astute about the challenges that we face while he worked with young people. And getting back to our special guest is attorney Jamal Toussaint. Jamal Toussaint, as I said, is none but a thoroughbred. He's serious about what he's doing, and he's becoming one of the most popular and recognized attorneys in California, if not in the United States. We're going to let him start, and then we'll ask questions. Oh, and we got my brother, Ernest McBride, who is junior, who is the son of Ernest McBride Sr., who is recognized in Long Beach for starting the first NAACP, the Optima Club. They've named schools and recreation centers, the old rec area. They've named after him because of his tireless work in forcing Long Beach and liberalizing Long Beach to begin to hire black African-Americans and our black people, as well as organizing for social justice in the Long Beach area for the African-Americans. And so without further delay, as I said, I'm just, and Brother Ihe, is out of Detroit, and they've been having some serious weather. Brother Ihe is a strong, strong scholar and deep thinker who always have courageous questions about what's going on in the world. He's one of our panelists, along with Mashinda, who's out of Louisiana, who's a public servant and work with young people. with regards to them dealing with the various challenges of the law and the wicked South and what's going on there. And we deeply appreciate Brother he and Brother Mashinda, as well as Ernest McBride Jr. and Brother Rashiki Maskani, who is responsible for this platform. He comes on every Wednesday. He'll be coming on tomorrow, and he's responsible for the Conscious Corner at his expense, and he's allowed me to put this platform together. So without further delay, I don't want to take up no more time. I want to hear my brother, my friend, a young man that I watched grow up. He used to go by his house and his grandmother's house, Mady. We had to have good food all the time, and we just had a good time with Mady. And, you know, I can't even get into all the beauty and joy that she brought with her children, all the children, and just lighting up the Long Beach area. So without further delay, we got Attorney Jamal Tucson, as I said, one of the most prominent attorneys in the L.A. area, and this is a very special guest that we have tonight. So, Brother Attorney Jamal, Attorney Tucson, go ahead.
Thank you so much for that wonderful, wonderful introduction. Thank you for having me. I think the timing of it is perfect, given what's going on in the country and in the world for that matter, right? Obviously, I think we all recognize that internationally we are at war, but we have been at war for a long time here domestically, especially as it relates to the treatment of our people, the treatment of Black and brown people by the criminal justice system, law enforcement, and unfair legislation that has a disproportionate impact on us. I think, you know, the first point is, you know, kind of addressing the criminal justice system and how to navigate through that maze if you do find yourself and or a loved one involved in the criminal justice system. What do you do? Well, I think, you know, our first point is understanding here in California, right, the various roles that the various parties play in the process and how that impacts a person of color's access to justice. So I guess at the very first level is police officers who are, you know, charged with enforcing the law, which as we are aware is enforced unequally. So you're going to have a situation to where, you know, African Americans are far more likely to be pulled over, harassed, ultimately arrested. And then how that police report is written is oftentimes very different when it's involving a person of color, because police are simply making recommendations allegedly based off of what they objectively saw. And then they're submitting those recommendations to the district attorney if it's a felony here in California, or the city attorney if it is a misdemeanor. And then that prosecuting agency is then making a decision on what, if any, are the appropriate charges to file. And without really understanding the process, oftentimes we get the short end of the stick every step of the way. So from the initial encounter with police, when they are supposed to be making objective observations, to ultimately what they put down on the report, to the recommendations that go to the district attorney, and then ultimately they decide what, if any, are the appropriate charges. In our case, far more often, they're electing to file the most serious charges that they can, right? So there is this subjective, inherent unfairness kind of baked into the process. And then by the time you get to the courthouse, right, the judge essentially is supposed to be a neutral referee, but oftentimes the judge's hands are tied by the charges the district attorney has elected to file. A little bit about my background. For obviously over a decade, I started off doing criminal defense, and did it at a very high level, ultimately going on to represent some very prominent individuals prior to switching over to civil rights, in which we're directly protecting the rights of our people and going after law enforcement agencies, sheriff's department, the police department, and on a bigger level, counties, cities, and even states, the state of California and countries now, the United States with the Homeland Security and ICE, just really wreaking havoc on our community and not following any sort of laws or protocols and violating our civil rights, liberties. But, I want to kind of open the floor to you guys after giving that kind of brief overview of the criminal justice system and maybe address some pointed questions as to how we can get the best possible outcomes for our people. All right, brother, you may be muted. There you go.
All right, there. Hey, brother Ernest, you have any questions?
I really don't have any questions because I have been fortunate enough not to run into, a lot of police during my time. And then my dad only, times I had like real contact with them, like my dad had got the first African American police officer hired in the city of Long Beach back in the 40s, 43, and then I helped him kind of protest to make that happen. But and then I've, through my time growing up here in Long Beach, I've seen a lot of African American officers being put on the force. So
Okay.
we're pretty, I don't know, in my view there. I've met a lot of them personally, like through the NAACP meetings, because we try to stay in touch with the police and invite them to our monthly meetings. And then so far, things have been running pretty good. So.
Okay. All right. Brother Joe, Brother Him, Historian Henrik, do you have any questions?
No, I don't.
Not right now. What about you, Mashinda?
Not right now. I just want to thank the guests for coming on and talking, but I don't have any questions at this time.
Then. Trying to see. Rashiki? He may have stepped away. Ahi?
What about this NHS, brother? I know this is like, they weren't really also, but you say you have to know the rules. Or they will take advantage of you. Where today it seems like the Constitution, they're not paying any attention to it. NHS is coming down here, and I've seen some videos where some of the brothers have handled them, and people have handled them, but not that's not always the case. They'll come in sometimes and just they're on a 100, and it seems like these people are not really don't really have a recourse. I'd just like your opinion on that.
Yes. I mean, I think, right, our constitutional rights are only as good or only as solid as the willingness of a court to enforce them. So oftentimes, what you will see is courts unwilling to hold law enforcement accountable to the same level that they would hold a regular citizen. The other component that is, I guess, really prevalent in the media with the Department of Homeland Security and ICE and, the killings that took place here in Los Angeles with one of my clients, Keith Porter Jr., and in Minnesota as well, is this whole concept of qualified immunity and what that really means for law enforcement and why do we give them qualified immunity. And essentially what that means is, unless a mistake made by a law enforcement officer during the course and a scope of his employment or her employment is essentially horrific, meaning, you know, a conscious disregard, you know, of the constitutional and human rights of another, it is very hard to hold a law enforcement officer accountable because of that concept of qualified immunity. And when we talk about hold accountable, I'm not even talking about giving them jail time. I'm just talking about civil penalties in terms of them maybe being exposed to some level of monetary damages. So I completely agree and concur with your sentiment. And I would just reiterate, you know, our rights are only, I guess, as valuable as the willingness of the court to uphold them. But certainly if we don't know our rights, we can't even demand that a court uphold them. So conversations like the conversation we're having here today are critical.
Brother, you got your hands full out there. Of course, you know that your sheriff department, they kill on an average a person a day, brown and black people. So I'm just going to assume that the courts are not willing to hold the sheriffs accountable. Even with this habitual homicide of black and brown men.
Well, the problem is, right, who's even overlooking the sheriff's giving a fair and independent investigation to make sure when they do kill somebody that it's even being to an appropriate law enforcement agency. Given the close proximity in which the sheriff and the district attorney work together every day, it's unlikely that we could expect a fair and transparent investigation of their counterpart, a law enforcement agency, when they do something wrong. That's why oftentimes what you see is us calling for the attorney general to come in and investigate the people that's supposed to be investigated.
Thank you, my brother.
No problem.
Okay, Joe, just a minute. Hey, Brother Abraham, you have any question? You're on mute. You're on mute. There you are.
Oh, okay, can you hear me?
Yeah.
I don't have any questions. I have a comment, though. It's really up to every man and woman, especially black men and women here in America, to draw the line as far as what you're willing to accept from, you know, law enforcement, the judicial system, and whatnot, the powers that be. And in taking that stand, you have to move with intelligence and just common courtesy and respect for all human beings. As I say, all that to say is that when you encounter law enforcement, as a black man, I know what I like to do is to acknowledge the fact that they are law enforcement. I like to show the utmost respect and behave myself in an upright and a law-abiding capacity. However, with that being said, we all know that the law enforcement sometimes can become dangerous to us. And when that takes place, what you should do is protect your life. And after that, you let the chips fall where they may. You have to do what you have to do. But the step one, when you encounter law enforcement, do not be a problem. However, like I said, you know, regardless of your behavior and your character, if you come across the type of situation that will end your life, you know, you have to protect yourself, protect your life, protect your community, and take a stand. And you want to be on the right side of the law at all times. So that's just my comment. And I know, go ahead. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I completely agree with your comment, and I guess what I've spoken to is kind of the aftermath from the legal side. But the biggest thing we can do is exactly what you said: be courteous, be polite, be respectful. Oftentimes, situations are being escalated when they don't need to be escalated. And I think if we approach every encounter with respect, hopefully that will lead to a favorable outcome. There are times when even that is not enough. But as a starting point, as a general rule, I definitely concur in terms of the respect that not just we should give law enforcement, but that we should give every citizen.
Thank you, Embry Hammond, Attorney Tucson. I just have a few questions that I want, but there's somebody that I can't make out their phone. It's TNOUS something. But anyway, I guess they're on their phone. It's TINNO. U572AC. If you want to come in, let me know. Brother Joe, you had your hand up?
Just comment on what the other brother was saying. Words need fuller when you run into the police. Don't fuss, don't fight, and don't flee. That's my comment on that. And to the attorney, I'm friends with Franchelle, the brother who got killed by the ICE, alleged ICE agent out of Northridge. And my question is, do you see his family having a civil or criminal case against ICE, or has anybody dealt with ICE like that in a court of law and have won?
So I guess there is two parts and components to your question. The first is the criminal aspect of it. The criminal aspect, ultimately, we have little to no say so in. That is going to be a determination made by LAPD and the district attorney. Ultimately, we have requested the Attorney General Rob Bonta to come in and conduct an independent investigation. The civil ramifications for ICE or the Department of Homeland Security will play out later in a federal court, right? And certainly we are moving forward to bring a civil cause of action. But right now, our biggest concern that we have yet to get is a level of transparency in terms of what happened or everything that the LAPD knows to have happened. And once we have that, I think it will go a long ways toward, providing some level of comfort to the family and giving us clarity as we begin to navigate civilly against this particular ICE officer, as well as the Department of Homeland Security as a whole.
Appreciate it.
No problem.
I wish this man would. I have a few questions, Attorney Tucson. First of all, what made you want to be an attorney, and when did you decide that you was going to pursue that as a career? And how challenging is it to become one for black people?
So I probably decided, I would say, my junior year when I was at Morehouse. And I always like to talk. So, the ability to effectively communicate and advocate your position is critical, as a trial lawyer. So it was kind of a natural segment for me to go into law. My journey ultimately to where I'm at now was kind of twofold. So I spent half my time as an NFL agent. I spent the other half starting off as a public defender, defending, black and brown people every day because I was passionate about making a difference, and then ultimately going on to launch my own law firm. What I would say is there are barriers every step of the way for a person of color, right? It's, getting the, of course, educational requirement. It's then passing the California bar, which is probably the hardest bar outside of New York. And then there is the challenges that we just face as a person of color on a day-to-day basis. And when you're doing things the right way, right, maintaining and staying on the right side of things, because we oftentimes disproportionately get impacted even when we're lawyers, right? I've known several lawyers who have, lost their license to practice. So, short answer is there are no easy paths. Try and do everything the right way. Stay ethical, work hard, and stay committed to your goal, and you'll accomplish it.
Okay, the other question is, do you recommend young people who, there's certain crimes you can get an expungement? How challenging is it? Because that's a, I run across young people that had felonies 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and they never got them expunged. And it seems as if there's a lack of understanding of how to get it done. I know you have to go to the court and where you were sentenced, or either the court where that you committed the crime area in. So, but what do you think about expungement and how
We
challenging is it?
absolutely should be getting crimes of which we are no longer on probation or parole to the degree that we can expunged off our record. I think we need to take advantage when laws like this are passed, which certainly have the ability of helping us gain employment. Now, expungement is probably easier than it's ever been in the past 10 years. So that is something I would encourage everybody to do. There are oftentimes in every courthouse throughout, the state of California, a self-help desk near the clerk that will walk you through the steps you need to take, or you could contact your local public defender.
Just a minute. Is that a benefit to get your case expunged?
Yes, the benefit is it allows you to check unemployment applications that you have not been convicted of a crime, right? If whatever you got expunged is the only crime on your record, that is a huge benefit. Now, certain government employers or jobs that require a high-level security clearance will ultimately be able to find the conviction anyway. But for the majority of jobs, there is a significant benefit to coming in with a clean slate, so to speak.
What about California Certificate of Rehabilitation?
That's important. And the other thing you can also get, which is a little harder to get, is a factual declaration of innocence. And what that means is, if you are arrested but not convicted of a crime, and as a matter of law, there was no reason why you should have been arrested and you couldn't have been convicted, we can get all of that taken off as well.
When it comes down to, I think you appreciate what everybody said, if I understand correctly. I understand saying, be nice to police and all that, but what, our history with police, going all the way back to the first police department and the first criminal justice system, has been through racial discrimination, prejudice. The court in the Emmett Till case, they went back for what, 20 minutes, ate lunch, and came back and found them innocent. And then 30, 40 years later, they found the lady lied and guilty. But they had indicted her, but they didn't bring charges. But getting back to my point is that, you know, there is bad police. That's one part of the criminal justice system. There is bad juries and bad judges, and you know, bad district attorneys. I mean, with these rappers today, a couple of them got their cases dismissed because they spread a little money around, you know, and things of this nature. It was well documented in the newspaper, and I'm pretty sure you've encountered it, and that's why I think you're taking Brother Porter case, because he was shot for shooting his gun on New Year's, and the guy came out and just deputized himself and just shot him and killed him. So, you know, how do you feel about the challenges when you go into court and you know that the brother or sister is being railroaded, if you've seen that?
So I think you touched on a couple of important things there. The first thing, which we had not talked about up until this point, is the power of a jury trial, right? And the power of a quote-unquote jury or jurors of your peers. What oftentimes happens is we don't participate in the process enough, meaning, you know, we get the jury summoned and we try and figure out any type of way we can get out of it, not realizing how that is directly hurting our people. Because what happens is we never truly end up with a juror of our peers. We end up with 12 people that look anything like us or the community. They look like the people who are actually willing to come in for jury, which is unfortunately people who typically don't have any financial concerns, typically don't have stress of taking off of work. And so you end up with 12 individuals, right, who know nothing of what you're struggling against. They don't identify with you. They don't see you. And they think you must have been arrested for a reason. So that's a little of, as trial lawyers, what we're up against when we don't all willingly participate in the system. And if we're not willing to participate in the system, then we shouldn't complain about the outcome. So I think, you know, the first step in justice, I would tell individuals is show up to jury duty, be heard, participate. When they ask you questions, don't just say what you think will get you off the jury, but give a honest assessment of how you feel about the situation to maybe make everybody in that courtroom think, and you may save a life. So I think that is critical, critical. In terms of, you know, going back to even the Keith Porter situation, one of the things that struck out to me is he was feet away from his home when he was shot and killed by a quote-unquote off-duty ICE agent, right? For what should have been an offense that he was cited or even arrested for, we have these ICE agents who aren't properly trained handing out death sentences with no consequences. And to think about that happening in 2026 is horrific, but that is exactly what's happening over and over and over again until we begin to hold, you know, these individuals accountable. I don't think that's going to change. And that is part of my role, part of what the family is fighting so hard for, to get some level of justice, some level of fair play, some level of transparency to say, wait a second here, right? Why didn't you just simply wait for the police? What gave you the legal right to shoot and kill Keith Porter? And it's frustrating.
My other question is that we have movements. When Natasha Carlin got shot, was it Natasha? The Asian lady shot her.
Correct.
and the judge, the jury found her guilty. Guilty of manslaughter or something. And then the judge gave her probation. And most of the times when we get convicted, they arrest you right then and there. And then sometimes you have to go through the process of being evaluated. Are you suited for prison, what they call just sending you to prison for 90 days just to get an evaluation from the prison and things of this nature. Well, how do you navigate those type of situations? Because you got Black Lives Matter out there. You got the police commission that's supposed to be a check on a lot of these things of police abuse. And you have some, it seems like judges are not accountable. Even though they have a so-called ethic thing, because we're looking at the Supreme Court, they're getting all these bribes and things of this nature, people giving them money. I mean, what I'm saying is, how legitimate do you think the courts, police, and judicial system as a whole is? How much of, what percentage of you think is doing the right thing and the percentage of it is doing challenging things?
Right. So I would say that when you talk about a judge and how they decide to sentence or not sentence and give somebody probation, right? Typically, judges have histories. They have track records. I think it's incumbent upon the prosecuting agency and or the defense attorney, depending on what side of the spectrum you are on, to try and to the best of your ability get in front of a judge that you believe is going to give your respective party a fair shot. In California, we have what's a, you know, known as a peremptory challenge, and you have one per case, and you can remove any judge at the very beginning of any case if you believe that judge cannot be fair and impartial. So individuals have to know who they're in front of and have to kind of foresee what the likely outcome would be and say, no, I do not want to be in front of this particular judge. In terms of how many do I think are fair versus unfair, I think most judges want to try and do the right thing. I think oftentimes, they do the right thing in terms of what they can do by law. But a lot of cases, you know, especially in the federal court, depending on how they file, are filed with what's known as mandatory minimum and sentencing guidelines that give judges very limited flexibility at the conclusion of a criminal trial in what they can do or cannot do. In the state court, there is a little more flexibility. But I think, once again, going back to the starting point, it's very important that that lawyer representing you kind of knows the judge they're in front of. And if it's a judge who historically has not given clients in a similar situation a fair shake, you have to elect to get to a different judge.
What throws me off a little bit, Attorney Tucson, is when the law enforcement or our judge sometimes have a tendency, in some cases, to disregard fairness, and they come to court or even as police, their own bias. Now, you know, I've been demonstrating, fighting for justice for young people and police, and demonstrated in a lot of police cases where people were shot unnecessarily. And we've come a long way through struggle. And that justice that we're getting today, and bombed us out, saying, Mayor, go up and down the line. And when we look at enforcement was a part of, you know, attacking the black people and taking their property and shooting them and things of this nature and dropping. You're on the inside. A lot of what attorneys do is, unless they contract somebody to help write their motions and, you know, arguments and things of this nature, you know, there's some attorneys that have their own firm and they have a writer, and then there's some attorneys that do their own writing. My point is that, I mean, you're on the inside. How? And I'm trying to find the word. Because, you know, how do you really see the system from a black perspective as a young black man, not an attorney, but just as a black young man? I know you, the best way to not get in, just don't go. Just don't do nothing, but that's hard when they used to just arrest us for anything, you know what I mean? Walking down the street, four deep in a car at one time. And the young man in Colorado was just walking home. The other boy in, I think I get where he was just bought some Skittles and juice, and a vigilante killed him. And then this boy, Ruthenberg, or whatever his name, he had a gun and shot a couple of people. And they said he had the right to defend himself. And nobody was even after him. And the police saw him with the gun walking down the street. And he didn't get no case. How do you really see the system from a off the record or however you want to put it?
I think it's an excellent question. I think without struggle, there can be no progress. I think we have, to an extent, gotten complacent with the victory and the struggle that those who came before us made. I think there needs to be more people willing to speak up. I think there needs to be more people willing to say unpopular opinion. And I think there needs to be more fighter. I think we've gotten soft. And I think that softness has allowed, in many ways, the criminal justice system to regress, right? To take away some of the gains or the progress that was made. And it's resulted a very bad situation for black and brown people.
Brother Ernest, you have any more questions?
Not really, because it just kind of reminded me earlier, you hit upon the point, someone about, you know, being respectful when you, because you don't know what type of officer you confront, and you don't know how his day is. And I always try to tell his young kids is be respectful, because you got a person here that's got a badge. It gives him authority. He has a gun on his side, and you don't know how his day went, you know, when you confront him. So you need to just be respectful and then hope for the best, you know, because I had a friend of mine, I think one time we got stopped, and because I pulled up to a traffic light, and it was red, I stopped, and then I proceeded, no traffic was coming, so I proceeded around the corner, but a police cruiser happened to be coming down the street with his lights off, and so I didn't see the reflection of the light, so he pulled me over, and it was a black officer that my dad had helped, well, he got him hired, but he didn't know him personally, you know. But he pulled right away. He always said, "Well, McBride, what you pull out in front of me like that?" I said, "Well, Officer Dubois, I didn't see you because you were cruising down there with your lights off, and I didn't see the reflection of any lights because of the parked cars. And then I had a buddy in the car with me, and he said, "Who is that in the car with you in the back?" And I think they had a warrant out on one of my friends for non-support child payments. He said, "We've had a warrant, been looking for you for 6 months." And he starts cussing. Oh, I said, "Man, just be quiet and go. You know, don't confront the man and cause a problem that you don't have to." So I've run into things like that. But my dad, he always thought, you know, when they wanted him to recommend, when he got the first black officer hired, I wanted him to recommend somebody. He said, "No, I don't recommend anybody because you should be, you got enough blacks that apply. You got candidates there, but I don't recommend any, but you need to hire minorities." So that was probably the only thing, you know, in my younger days that I had a. I try to tell these young kids now, you know, be respectful, because if, you know, you put yourself in the officer's place, if you've had a rough day, you don't want anybody giving you a hard time, you know. So you try to just do what you can, I guess.
Brother Hembrick?
Yeah. I have some friends that send me a lot of YouTube and video stuff about the Africans being indigenous people, calling themselves Moors and whatnot. And some of the video footage that they send me makes reference to us being Moors and not having to follow, you know, statutes or laws, you know, that that the police be putting on us and whatnot. Do you know anything about that type of information?
I do not, but what I would say is, you know, that is somewhat dangerous because, you know, as a black man in this country, even when we follow the laws that are on the books, we still sometimes find ourselves in trouble. So if you're taking a position of because of certain descent or heritage, you are immune from the guidelines here, I can say without knowing too much about it, that is a surefire way to find yourself in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, I had a brother say that once. He told the judge, "Don't put me in jail, deport me." He said, "You can do that after you do your time." You know what I mean? That was his position. But again, back to Brother Ahi, you have any more questions?
Yes, brother. Earlier, you made reference to our people basically being satisfied. Professor Rye brings this up, how our middle class just sold us out. But earlier you said something about our people being satisfied. That's the middle class. My point here is this. They out to get us. And they killing us. And they using the people that got the stars on their chest and can carry a gun legally in the name of the municipality, state, county. And I was watching a YouTube about these young men that call themselves the Black Panthers. They're in New York. And these ICE agents would be patrolling, and the local police, and these young guys, was in New York, where they were actually carrying their firearms legally, because it's not legal to carry firearms in New York, is it? Chicago.
Chicago, they were carrying their firearms legally. And they had real big guns. And when the ICE agents approached them, or they approached the ICE agents, it was a whole different kind of conversation. Like, they were like, and they were talking the same thing, and then all the rest of them said, these are the rules, these are what you are to abide by, and we have these legally. Ours just happened to be bigger than yours. They were respectful, and they got on about their business. They cowards. You said that with the struggle, it's going to come some pain. Okay, here we are now. As a people, we can no longer just say, okay, I'm just going to go along with it. I'm going to be quiet because I want to live. They have to question if their actions are going to bring along their last, this might be my last day if I don't come correct. And we all following the law. You think you got some type of immunity, and I know I got rights. And in the areas where these young men are carrying the guns, and the guns just happen to be as big or bigger than those cowards, then it's a whole different conversation. And it's a time that we start looking at America a little differently and where our position is in it as Americans. And if we're going to call ourselves Americans, then that's going to have to come with a little bit of sacrifice, but they're going to get the message quick. Just like when the young boys in Missouri East, what's right there with Missouri and Illinois meet, and Jersey East and South East, and is it new? It's, I don't know. There's a St. Louis, East St. Louis and St. Louis. When those cops got out of line and those gang members said, okay, no fly zone, y'all open season. It didn't take 24 hours. It did not take 24 hours where they came with some type of resolution, because they cowards, and it's going to come to some type where we're going to have to take that type of stand as citizens and as having a right to carry arms and to defend ourselves and to stop being the victims. I just want to ask you, what do you think about that?
I think that a couple of things, right? One, you know, this concept of the middle class, I think the middle class has virtually been eliminated. I think, you know, the cost of living just a average life has become so out of reach for most of the people. I don't think there is a traditional middle class. I'm 47, like there was when I was growing up. I think what you propose is one way. I think another way that, you know, being a graduate of a HBCU, going to Morehouse now at 47, looking back, the benefit of having your own people pour into you, have your own people educate you. I think when you look at the history of HBCUs, often it was, you know, out of necessity because we didn't have any opportunity to go to a predominantly white institution. But by virtue of pouring into our youth and us pouring into them, not somebody else, I think we're going to achieve better outcome. I think, you know, the eye for an eye mentality is one way. And I think that's dangerous. I'm not saying, you know, for or against it, but I will be an advocate to getting back to controlling our own environment, pouring into our own economy and really supporting one another. And I think that is going to lead to better outcome than just assuming because we're American, right, we're going to get the same benefit as non-minorities in this country, which is not true. It's not going to happen.
I know that. What about security for our people?
I mean, I think we can set up security companies. I just think, you know, directly addressing your question, I just think I'm familiar with what happened in St. Louis, but I think there's layers to it, and I think it's much more complicated than them just saying, oh, it's a no-fly zone for 24 hours and then rectifying whatever differences were with the police. So I wouldn't go as far as being an advocate of that, no.
What about in your own backyard and you losing brothers every day with the police department? That's just the sheriff's county. Now, we're not talking about the local police, city, local, municipal departments. We talk about just the sheriff's department. What are we going to do about this genocide committed against us? And how can we stand up and still legally be able to defend ourselves against these people by any means necessary?
So go ahead. I'm sorry.
Look, you get to a point where some of us are tired of it. You see some of us, how we treat each other. We shooting each other. Well, I'm tired of you. I'm sure we shooting each other. Well, what would happen if we just stood up and said, well, I'm tired of you? That's a whole different psyche for when, okay, now I'm dealing with a man that just like me, just like this white boy that's willing to die for his, he willing to die for his. That's a whole different psyche, and you're going to change how you come and talk to me.
Nothing.
And so we dying anyway.
Right. I hear what you're saying, but nothing I'm saying is against the Second Amendment, right? I am a believer in owning firearms. I'm a believer in the Constitution. I'm a believer in your right to defend yourself. I don't take it as far as, and once again, I don't know what happened in St. Louis, right? But I just think that becomes a very deadly fight that we may not necessarily win. Do I believe you have a right to defend yourself? Absolutely. Do I believe you should arm yourself? Absolutely. Do I believe it should be within the confines of what is legally permissible according to the law? Yes.
That's what I'm saying. Okay. That's what I'm saying.
Brother, Brother Abraham, you have any bag of questions?
Got on mute. On mute.
I think
that on
you still on mute. There you
well,
go.
To the point being made, like I said, you know, listen, you got to protect yourself at all times. You know, that's your responsibility. You know, if your life is being threatened, you know, don't be a buster. You understand? You have to protect yourself. And every man should have a set of principles that he lives by, that he willing to kill for, and willing to die about. You have to decide what line it is that you're not going to allow someone to cross. And you have to have that made up in your mind before you leave the house every day. So when it comes to protecting yourself, when it comes to you know, standing on business, so to speak, you know, I'm for that 100%. You know, if someone is threatening your life, regardless if it's a everyday citizen, some racist white folks, a police officer, and they cross your line, you know, you have to handle your business and protect yourself. And you know, I'm for everyone having one, the ability to do so, and two, being responsible for your safety and your life.
Yeah.
So I'll leave it there.
Well, you know, Brother Joe, Brother Henry, go ahead.
I used to be trapped all the time back in the day and got busted. Oh, am I on mute?
No,
it was a little unclear, but it's clear now.
And my question is, what are the laws in California about carrying a weapon in the vehicle now? I know what it used to be. Has it changed or still the same about the bullets got to be separate from the gun, one in the trunk and one somewhere else, which don't do nobody no good?
The laws are still the same. However, recently there was a passage, and it may still be on appeal. I don't know if it has become law. But up until recently, the laws were still the same in terms of keeping the gun and the ammo separated and in a locked capacity for transportation while inside the car.
How good that do.
All right. Brother Jamal, I just got Brother Rashiki, do you have any questions? He may have stepped away. But Attorney Jamal, one of the challenging things for anybody, is particularly poor African Americans, is the affordability of a good attorney. I mean, there's some attorneys up to $500 or more an hour. That means if you call them and talk 10 minutes, they charge you the $500. How do you feel? I mean, I know that it's rough, and most attorneys got to pay for a lot of other things. That, you know, they have to travel all over the county. They have to, sometimes pay people to write their briefs. It depends on their situation. Some belong to a firm. Some are individuals, like you have your own firm. Why is it so expensive, and how challenging it is for poor people to get an attorney if the court don't appoint them one, if they don't qualify for a court appointment?
So typically everybody is going to qualify for some level of a court-appointed attorney for the most part, whether that be a public defender, an alternate public defender, or bar panel. On the civil side, right, which is primarily what I do, 99% of my cases now, a attorney is charging you nothing up front. They're taking that on a contingency case, saying, I believe in your case and I believe I'm going to win. In terms of the affordability on a criminal defense side, I think my advice to everyone typically is, if you cannot get or afford one of these quote-unquote high-priced, high-power attorneys with significant experience, you are better off working with the public defender. And public defenders vary. There are incredible public defenders. There are public defenders that are not so incredible. But it's the exact same for private lawyers. There are incredible private lawyers, and there are private lawyers that are not so great. In terms of the cost, it's kind of baked into that lawyer's reputation and experience. When you're talking about a private lawyer, you're not just hiring him. You're probably hiring the 30 years of cases that he's won, and when he comes in the courtroom, the relationships that he demands. If that's not feasible, I always recommend, do not just go grab a lawyer just because they are a private lawyer. And lawyers who are dedicated to their craft, who want to see you win. The difference may be you are not going to get hand-holding. They are not going to, you know, make you feel great about the situation, but that is not going to change the outcome if they know what they're doing inside the courtroom.
First of all, we want to thank you for coming on. I mean, it's been incredible. But I want to say this to specifically you, Attorney Tucson, and Brother Ibrahim. See, Brother Ibrahim sitting back there like he don't know. But his father was one of the most powerful that building shot his father. And I was one of the first speakers at the mosque in Compton when he opened it up. Brother Abraham had seen his father step up and organize and get things together from that standpoint. And I'm just happy he's on. And I'm trying to get his number so we can get some of that knowledge that his father put into him. And his mother, who was an educator, counselor, and things of this nature, Chandra Muhammad. Great people, man. I mean, see, we was in the trenches. And me and your father, Brother Tucson, Larry, see, we go way back. See, we just lost a good friend, the Nichols, Brother Nichols, who died.
Woodrow.
And things of this nature. I mean, we was in the front line in Long Beach, Compton, Carson, and things of this nature. But even though your father was very smooth, but he was smart. You understand? And he knew how to handle himself. But Abraham, the same way, y'all families are well-known, well-respected, and honored for the contributions they've made. Your father helped a lot of people in contract work and helping them get their houses together, helping them, you know, he just did, Brother Tucson. And it's just good to have both of y'all on while we're there. Who's that Shabazz? Who's that? He just came on. Brother Shabazz? We can't hear you. Okay, 1 minute. Go ahead, Brother Joe.
Yeah, brother, I'm asking a question. When I was 10 years old, the police hit my father's door and beat him unconscious in a coma, and he didn't survive. My question is there any action on a case that's that old? This was before 65, might have been 63 when I was 10. I'm 72 years old now. And until I was in my 30s, I was thinking about offing a policeman for a long time. Finally snapped out of it. But my question is there any statute of limitations on that situation that I can look into to see if something could have been done about that way back then? Because they kicked in the wrong door by mistake. And he was a military man who had a steel plate in his head and didn't take no stuff from nobody. And the police kicked in his door. He jumped up fighting them, and they beat him until he was unconscious, and he never came out of it. So that's my question.
So it's twofold. One, obviously, sorry, you know, for your loss and what happened. I think from a civil perspective, unfortunately, the statute of limitations in federal court is 2 years. If you are going to bring a suit against law enforcement in state court, you have to start the initial claim within 6 months. So, you know, both of those statutes have passed it. In terms of criminal consequences, there are no statute of limitations for murder. So certainly if there was evidence that was not looked into, that should have been, nothing stops, you know, the district attorney or the prosecutor from looking into that if they so elected to do so.
Them crackers is probably dead now anyway. And my father would have been 90 some by this time, you know. So the
they call them cold cases, and like Attorney Tucson said, you know, a judge don't have the power to arrest. He only can refer you or charge you with contempt, or ask them to take you into custody. But the police don't have to do it because the judge don't have that power. But if you can get that, as an attorney Tucson says, evidence, information, that's credible information to make them want to open up the case, and you got a police officer in that area that would like to do a cold case, even though those people are dead. A lot of people they found that killed civil rights workers are dead, but they still brought them back and in some cases charged them. Brother Shabazz, is your phone work? Is it working yet? Okay, we're going to let Brother Attorney Tucson go, and because I know how the life is as an attorney in your own personal life. We appreciate all your time, Jamal, and I can't tell you how honored I am to see how you have grown, see how you have prospered, and how you've become one of the most noticed attorneys and recognized attorney in this area for your ability to win cases. And that's the other question. What about many attorneys, even in civil cases, they want to settle quick, and then criminal cases, they want to make a deal, and then sometimes, the police overcharge you, so you plead guilty, or the district attorney overcharge you, so you plead guilty, so they can say they have so many people found guilty in L.A. County or convicted. Do you see any of that? Are you hearing any of that?
Absolutely. And I think, a lot of what an individual's outcome could be when they're facing charges is unfortunately based off of where it happened, right? You have some cases, or some courts rather, like Long Beach, who are notorious for being harsher, right? Versus CCB, which is located at 210 West Temple, because of the volume simply at that courthouse, you may have a better opportunity. So you may have two individuals who are charged with and maybe have done the exact same thing, but you're going to see two very different outcomes depending on the courthouse that case goes to. You're on mute.
It's been a pleasure to have you on, Brother Jamal. And if there's any personal injury cases or criminal cases, and people ask me who to get, I'm going to recommend you, my brother. Straight out the box, So I just want you to keep doing what you're doing, because your reputation is just strong, and your commitment to justice is strong. And we very seldom have attorneys that are sincere about that. Some of them are just, they just want their money because they got bills, student loans, and all kind of stuff that they got to deal with, taxes, and everything else, keeping records, paying the people to keep up with their books. It's a lot to operating your own business. But we want to thank you for all the beauty and knowledge you shared with us tonight. And we wish you blessings without number, all good things without end. All right. And we're going to
thank you so much for having me. We have to continue the fight. We have to continue to educate ourselves, continue to know our rights, continue to have backbone and stand up for our rights. Justice is something that is never given. It's always earned, and it's always a sacrifice on that other end. So I think we need to be mindful of that as we move through life, and with the understanding that just because it's not us today, it could be us or somebody we care very deeply about tomorrow. So we need to stand up for all injustice everywhere when we see it. You're muted.
Rashiki, you have a guest for tomorrow?
Yes. Dr. Hankey, topic is real food.
Real food? Okay. We have Dr. Hankey going to be on tomorrow. talking about nutritional and healthy eating and things of that nature, which is very good. Number one thing in life is your health. I don't care how much money you got to have health. Brother Shabazz, did you ever come off a mute? I don't think so. So anyway, everybody, we wish everybody a good Wednesday. Oh, brother, you have your hand up, Ernest?
No.
Okay. And again, Brother Tucson, I thank you again for coming on and spending your time with us. And
thank you for having me.
All right.
All right, take care.